What I do is, and my favorite work is in working with the Hebrew Bible. It is that not because there is something holy about this text, but because I see there insights that were far beyond what was going on in the society around them when these developed, a way of viewing life that was radical. Now it's supposed to be conservative. It was radical then, it's radical now. Everybody knows what the Bible says because somebody says, the Bible says, and then you have to know that's the right thing. And everybody knows it focuses with a laser beam on two things. God will get you if you step out of line. And that religion and life itself is about what happens to you after you die. Everybody knows. The message is, if you do good, good things will happen to you. If you do bad, bad things will happen to you, because that's the way the world works, and that's the way there's a God who operates. Everybody knows this. Mother said, be good to people, and they'll be good to you. Be nice to people, and they'll be nice to you. Mother was wrong. But what one finds in the Hebrew Bible, and actually I think through the Christian New Testament as well, is certainly some of that argument that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. The book of Proverbs particularly promotes that view. Proverbs is loved by many people for the nice little pieces of wisdom it gives. When I lived in Georgia, there was a financial advisor there who was a very committed fundamentalist Christian who on his board out front always had a biblical passage, always from the Proverbs, always about how if you do the right thing, you can do well. He's a financial advisor. I never noticed in all the years I was there, over 20 years, a message on his board that quoted Jesus saying, go sell all that you have and give to the poor. He preferred Proverbs. And Proverbs has some of that in it. The Lord will not let the righteous go hungry, but he denies the wicked what they crave. No harm falls to the righteous, but the wicked will have their full fill of misfortune. The righteous man eats to his heart's content, but the belly of the wicked is empty. Righteousness protects him who is blameless, but sin overthrows the wicked. It's a nice, comfortable kind of way of looking at life. And we buy into it, many people, because we hate the thought of a random world where bad things can happen to good people unless something is causing it or unless they have caused it. So some of that view of reward, a reward-punishment world, is a part of life. If you remember, some of you may, the old television series Maude, when Maude was always saying to Arthur, God's going to get you for that, Arthur. You know, that's a philosophy that people buy into, and there is a bit of it in the Bible as well. And there is a lot of that salvation, hell and heaven Christianity, but far less than people think. In the Hebrew Bible, very, very, very little talk about an afterlife. They didn't believe in that. Didn't come until very late in the latest of the writings when the Greeks began to have some influence on Hebrew thought. There's not nearly as much of it in the Christian New Testament as the preachers would have you believe there is. because there is another view of life that's there throughout the Hebrew Bible, that's there throughout Christianity. It's more prevalent than anything else. It is the picture of a political and a social dream, an overwhelming concern for a world that will be marked by compassion, justice, legal and economic, peace, and compassion. It's a call to shape a world in the ways in which all the parts of creation can have the opportunity to develop to their full potential. That's the vision I find in most of the Hebrew Bible, and I find in the early Jesus movement. Some people have caught this third vision, not of reward and punishment or heaven and hell, but this vision of creating a world of compassion, justice, and peace. I think this denomination has caught that. Some of the other denominations have caught some of that vision, including my own, but they find it hard to give up the reward and punishment part of it. The heaven and hell schema, because it so dominates society and is so beneficial to the religious group. You may make a mistake, and you could suffer in the here and now for it, or in the hereafter. But we have a system that will offer you forgiveness. Come to us. We can take care of it for you. Keep them afraid, reward and punishment, heaven and hell, and they'll be dependent on you. It's a story, an old story out of Texas, a guy named Orville Hollingsworth, Queen City, Texas. Orville was a former Marine. He had served in combat in Korea. He chaired the committee of the local Veterans of Foreign Wars when they applied for a liquor license. Well, the local clergy opposed that. This was a decent, God-fearing community. They didn't need liquor being served at the VFW. Orville wrote a letter to the newspaper. He talked about the contributions of veterans to freedom, how they had risked their lives, about how many of them carried wounds with them daily. And he said men like that ought to be able to have a drink once in a while if they feel like it. Orville was 43 years old. And in the midst of the controversy with the local religious leaders, he was tearing down an old house. A supporting beam collapsed and Orville was killed. Reverend Young, one of the ministers, defenders of God and community, whom Orville had challenged, wrote a letter to the newspaper. He said, "The last man to contradict our stand is dead. Be careful what you do. God gets blasphemers out of the way." And poor Orville's wife joined in. She said, "I don't know why God took Orville. I know God punished David by taking his son. I guess God was gracious. God could have taken our daughter." A human tragedy had taken place. A 43-year-old man was dead. One can explain that. Termites, Orville's carelessness as he worked. It was meaningless and tragic and now absurd. It made no sense. It shouldn't have happened. But the people most eager to see God in it, that reward and punishment, were the two ministers whom Orville had embarrassed. They read delightedly as God's retribution, and they told us more about themselves than they told about God. And Orville's wife simply becomes a helpless wretch. There is this common thing that grips people, that what happens is the result of a reward and punishment universe. And surprisingly enough, there are arguments within the biblical text itself against that kind of understanding. One of them is the book of Ecclesiastes that I want to talk a little bit more about today. I'd like to have time to talk about it in more detail, but I'll try not to get too detailed with it. The other is the book of Job. Generally misunderstood, because like Ecclesiastes, Job has to be tamed to fit the pattern. The book of Job is not about why bad things happen to good people. It has skillfully done this drama of Job, the arguments back and forth about, do good people get good things and bad people get bad things? And Job's friends make that argument with him. You must have done something wrong. He kept insisting he hadn't. He was not, by the way. I grew up learning about the patience of Job. If you read it, he's not patient at all. He's angry. He's frustrated. He denies having done anything wrong, and the author has set it up that he's that kind of character. And what that book points to is the question the author is addressing is, can people be good if they're not getting rewarded for it or not afraid of punishment for it? It's a very different understanding of it, what I call disinterested piety. Will people do the right thing without your having to scare them about it? Well, it's a marvelous book. Again, one that would be fun to deal with for some time. But the writer of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, Koheleth, the Hebrew word that's used there, says, you know, those people in Proverbs looked around and they said, here we see it. Bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people. He said, I've looked around and that's not what I see. I see that people do some terrible things and there's never punishment for them. I see that people do some good things and they have horrible tragedy happen to them. He's saying, look around, use your own eyes. And I would say with him to the people in Proverbs, I would tell them about Orville. I would tell them about the Reynolds family in Boston during the bombing at the Boston Marathon. An 8-year-old killed. A mother with serious head injuries. A 6-year-old who lost a leg. And I would say to those friends of Job who said, we've never seen a good man suffer. You haven't seen this family. And I listened to the words of a woman who was on the other side of the street, who was not hurt, who said it was just meant to be that I was not hurt. And I want to say, have you thought about what that says about the Reynolds family? About what it means to them? Old Job's friend said, think now, who that was ever innocent ever perished? Who that was innocent ever perished? Or when were the upright ever cut off? And the author of Ecclesiastes is arguing with that whole understanding. He goes through it. He says, there's no way in this world that you can avoid the tragedies that come. There's no kind of system that makes it all logical. He says, I look around and I see that the wise are superior to the fools, but I know the same fate awaits them all. So I reflected, and he sees himself as a wise man. He's the teacher, that the fate of the fool is also destined for me. I came to the conclusion that was futile. You remember, many of you, the opening of Ecclesiastes, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, futile, chasing after the wind. You think you can prevent things by this? And he said, no, we all end up dead. All the same. He doesn't have a concern about life after death because the Hebrews didn't have that concern. He says, you can't prevent the suffering that comes in life from coming. Some things we can prevent, of course. I smoke a pipe all the time. I shouldn't. And if I get sick from that, it's not God's will. It's not fate. It's my stupidity. So you can prevent some things. But tragedies come that have nothing to do with things from nature. Foolishness of people, that's just the way life is, the writer of Ecclesiastes says. He says it much more beautifully than that. You can't keep from dying. You can't keep tragedy and such from coming. So what can you do? And he's giving his advice to young men, young people, mostly men then, you would think about giving advice to. He says, this is what you do with life. Go eat your bread with enjoyment, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has approved of what you do. Let your clothes be always freshly washed and your head never lack ointment. Get a new pair of shoes and wear some perfume. Enjoy life, he says, with the person you love. All the fleeting days of your life. For that alone is what you can get out of life and out of what you acquire under the sun. Whatever it's in your power to do, do it with all your might, for there isn't anything later. This is it. He said, this is what I have seen to be good. It is fitting to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of life you have. And it's a gift that you should eat and drink and take pleasure in all your toil. Ecclesiastes, by the way, Koheleth, the writer, could have written that first hymn we sang. He disputes the whole idea of reward and punishment, religion. And he offers instead a vision of enjoying the gift of life that one has been given. He has a metaphor for old age, one that I come more and more to be aware of and to understand. He says, be aware, young person. The day comes when the knees bend and the back bows. When the sound of the grinding is no longer heard. The teeth are not much good anymore. They begin to fail. When one who looks out the window sees dimly, the eyes start to go. When the song of the bird awakens you, insomnia, the chirping of a tiny little bird. It's a wonderful little sort of metaphoric description of what comes. Saying, so now, enjoy life. Eat your bread with enjoyment. Drink your wine with a merry heart. Enjoy a nice pair of shoes and perk yourself up with a little fragrance and enjoy life with the ones you love. Do the things you love, the good things you can do as a human being, That's what life is about. His words are caught, in one sense, by the old words from Irving Berlin in Follow the Fleet. I'm too young to have seen this, but Berlin catches them in a newer way. There may be trouble ahead, and while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while you still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. There will be. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Koheleth, the writer of Ecclesiastes, would have loved it. And I know the day will possibly come when I may not be able to dance with Jane anymore. When the legs, mine or hers, probably mine, will give out and won't allow it. I know the day may come when I might not have her to care for me. And as importantly, I might not have her to care for, to lavish my love on. And I know that someday, maybe she'll be with someone else. And I'll be happy if she dances again. Enjoy life with the person you love all the fleeting days that have been granted to you, Koheleth says. Keep dancing. And even if you can't dance like Fred Astaire, as I do, of course, and even if the partner isn't there now, there are other kinds of dancing. I can still tap my toes or feel a twinkle in my eyes or feel my heart beat to a rhythm, my body sway a little to a remembered and still present joy from across the years. And I can smile at that vision. The writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, don't get so hung up on this reward and punishment, this religion that controls. Enjoy the life you've been given. Life is strange and unpredictable and sometimes tragic. It is also filled with such moments of joy and wonder and warmth that no tragedy can erase them. And it's filled with all kinds of music. So, flamenco or waltz, two-step or hora, let's dance.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music and dance. The moon humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music.